Billy Graham's World, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Billy Graham leaves behind a huge legacy here in the U.S., but also all around the globe.
Love one another!
서로 사랑하셔야 됩니다.
And that is the message I want to leave as I go back to America. Love one another in Korea.
He preached the exact same gospel message in Madison Square Garden in New York as he did in North Korea or behind the Soviet Iron Curtain.
Plus, the American coach at the helm of Afghanistan's women's national soccer team.
The war is above my pay grade, but the people are amazing, and I know what they want for their country. And if we can help in any way, any little tidbit of opportunity, I think that we're giving back.
Those stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you here today. I grew up in North Carolina, Billy Graham's home state, and where he died today. Graham's legacy there is massive, and today, with the announcement of his death, he's on the mind of a lot of North Carolinians, not to mention the country. But I also think about all the other countries around the globe where he's brought his evangelism over the years.
From all over Britain, people have come to the final meeting of Billy Graham's Greater London Crusade.
Thousands are turning to God and are finding peace, security, happiness, and joy in this age of uncertainty and confusion.
The cosmopolitan hub of East Africa is Nairobi, Kenya. At a meeting specially held for missionaries and ministers, men and women came from all across East Africa.
I know that you have listened through much difficulty through true translations. But God has spoken to your heart. There are many people today that need to come and say yes.
서로 사랑하라.
Love one another.
서로 사랑하라.
Love one another.
서로 사랑하라.
I say to you as Christians today.
오늘 성도 여러분들에게 제가 말씀드리고 싶은 것은
Love one another.
서로 사랑하셔야 됩니다.
And that is the message I want to leave as I go back to America. Love one another in Korea.
That final clip there is from Graham's visit to South Korea in 1973. Graham counseled American presidents going back to Harry Truman, and he met with dictators and royalty. The World's religion correspondent Matthew Bell joins me now in the studio. So Reverend Graham was 99, the son of a North Carolina farmer, went on to launch this global Christian movement, preached to packed stadiums, reached millions, tens of millions of people around the globe. We just got a pretty good sense of his international reach. What kind of reaction have you been seeing today, Matthew?
It's really an outpouring of just recognizing Billy Graham's career, his life, as just this sort of incomparable figure in global Christianity. You know, he's referred to as America's pastor. He's called a towering figure in Christianity. You see it all over Twitter. You see it in the obituaries today. I talked about this today with Dr. Russell Moore. He's with the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission at the Southern Baptist Convention. And Moore said, it's really hard to overstate just how big Reverend Graham was.
Well, I think Billy Graham was uniquely gifted. In my view, he was the greatest Christian evangelist since the Apostle Paul in terms of influence all around the world. But I think behind that was the sense that Billy Graham so obviously believed his own gospel and his own message. And so he spoke with authority. And so I think in a time when many people are cynical and skeptical, not just about religious figures, but about any authority figures, Billy Graham was the real deal.
How do you characterize that saying? I mean, comparing him to St. Paul is pretty huge. How do you sort of point to Billy Graham's legacy, especially internationally?
One can hardly be around any gathering of Christians anywhere in the world, literally anywhere in the world, and not find at least some of them who either came to faith in Christ listening to Billy Graham in person or over television or some other media platform. The sheer ripple effect of his ministry is unbelievable across the world.
I was just watching him, Billy Graham, speaking. I think it was 1994. He had just gotten back from, I think, his second trip to North Korea. And I thought, what a sort of quixotic mission to try to go and talk about the gospel in a place like North Korea, of all places. How do you How do you explain that?
Well, and of course, he was doing that in many places for many years. Billy Graham would go behind the Iron Curtain and preach the gospel in the former Soviet Union and in Soviet states all over the place during the height of the Cold War. And he did so as someone who was completely unafraid of opposition to him, I think, again, because he really did believe that his ultimate accountability was before the judgment seat of Christ. And so he was granted freedom to be able to preach in places that others weren't. But when he arrived there, he never cut the message back. He never tailored it out of fear.
We found some really interesting audio, Dr. Moore, from one of Billy Graham's trips to South Africa.
From what I've already heard, that things are beginning to change in South Africa. I think they have to change, and I think the people realize that change is on the way.
What kind of change are you referring to?
Well, I think that that apartheid is not going to work.
In fact, one of the events, they sort of did away with segregation for the time being, and they had crowds that were mixed race, and Graham preached directly about this topic. Did he do that here, too, in the United States?
Yes, he did. He was doing that very early in the era of Jim Crow. And he was doing that in a way that was speaking to the consciences of white Southerners in order to say, if you really believe the gospel that you claim to believe, then that entails the equality of all people created in the image of God. And it entails a common destiny together in heaven, which means that the church should be reconciled and united right now. These are things that were very unusual at the time in which he was making those claims, making those statements. But he had the sort of gravity and authority that people were willing to listen to it.
He got some pushback about that.
He got quite a bit of pushback. Billy Graham received pushback for almost everything that he did. And some people look back and see the fact that Billy Graham is universally loved for the most part right now. But to realize just how controversial he was when he was innovating with new technologies, when he was speaking to integrated audiences, it really at every step of the way there were people who were coming against him. But he didn't back down. He had a very keen sense of who he was and what his calling was, and so he pressed forward.
That's Russell Moore. He's with the Southern Baptist Convention, speaking there with my colleague Matthew Bell about the late Billy Graham, a remarkable man. Matthew's still with us. And one final note on Graham, Matthew. As I said, I grew up in Graham's home state of North Carolina. And if he came to town to preach, it was amazing the sway he had over people, even people I'd thought of as fairly secular. And that allure, if you were an outsider, if you were Jewish, for example, it was impressive and also a bit overwhelming. And speaking of controversy, I can't forget the Nixon tapes. When they came out, there was Billy Graham pushing the conspiracy of the Jewish control of the media.
Right. You're referring to the tapes recorded in the White House in conversations with the president, Richard Nixon. Billy Graham had become close to him. And the comments are rough. They're talking about Jewish conspiracy and control of the media and control of pornography. Later on, this came out in 2002, I think, was when the tapes came out. And Billy Graham said that he didn't remember saying those things, but he apologized for them. And then in later years, it's interesting that Graham had said in interviews also that he, looking back at the span of his career, which went on for something like 70 years as a public figure, that he regretted being involved in politics at certain points in his life. He wishes he would have stepped away from politics. And that's something that Russell Moore brought up too and said that maybe this is something that Christian leaders need to take account of today.
That's the world's Matthew Bell from our religion desk, helping us remember the late Billy Graham, who died today at the age of 99. Matthew, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
But Billy Graham did bring his brand of religion into the political space. It wasn't such a stretch, though. For a long time, Americans thought of themselves as one nation under God, a Protestant Christian God. And then in the early part of the last century, a movement emerged designed to counter that narrative. And it became a major public campaign. The world's Jennifer Gorin looks back at National Brotherhood Week.
I recently saw a story in Foreign Policy magazine, and it mentioned a big PR campaign in the U.S. that helped overcome racial and religious hatred in the 1950s and 60s. I didn't know what it was talking about, So I called up the writer, and she told me it was National Brotherhood Week. And I thought, oh, I've heard of that.
Oh, the Protestants hate the Catholics, and the Catholics hate the Protestants, and the Hindus hate the Muslims, and everybody hates the Jews. But during National Brotherhood Week, National Brotherhood Week, it's National Everyone Smile at One Anotherhood Week.
That's Tom Lehrer, a math professor turned satirist. My parents had the record when I was a kid. I just didn't realize that National Brotherhood Week was a real thing. It turns out that it was, and it was a big deal for a long time. National Brotherhood Week had its roots in the 1920s, when fear and hatred of immigrants, Jews, and Catholics was on the rise. A group called the National Conference of Christians and Jews formed to counter the kind of intolerance they saw around them. So they came up with the idea for a traveling roadshow.
Something they called the Tolerance Trio.
This is Kevin Schultz, a historian at the University of Illinois at Chicago.
Where a Jewish rabbi and a Protestant minister and a Catholic priest would travel the country and go from city to city to city, rent out halls, and talk about the typical stereotypes that other people might have about, say, Jews being overly interested in money and Catholics wanting to overturn democracy. And they would make jokes to each other, and it was entertainment. And people in this entertainment would learn about how false some of the stereotypes were. And the end message of all of this was tolerance.
The idea took off, and soon there were multiple tolerance trios. They were such a hit that it led to a National Brotherhood Day. It was time to coincide with George Washington's birthday, to emphasize its Americanness. Here's historian Ronit Stahl.
The president, starting with FDR, was the honorary co-chairman of Brotherhood Week, so there was usually some sort of proclamation or speech.
I am happy to speak to you from my home on the evening of a Sabbath day, which has been observed in so many of your home communities as Brotherhood Day.
And so not everyone loved it. You know, some people were suspicious of this type of interfaith engagement, but for the most part, it was quite popular.
So popular that they expanded it to a week in the late 30s. Later, during World War II, this notion of brotherhood helped unite the country. Americans saw themselves as committed to tolerance and fairness, in contrast to the Nazis and fascists they were fighting against. Then, with the arrival of the Cold War, brotherhood fit our idea of Americans as people of faith, fighting the godless communists in the Soviet Union. There were posters, comic books, songs, even a short film by Frank Sinatra to promote tolerance.
Look, fellas, religion makes no difference, except maybe to a Nazi or somebody as stupid. Why, people all over the world worship God in many different ways. God created everybody. He didn't create one people better than another.
He got an honorary Academy Award for that, by the way. The Ad Council, the people who brought you Smokey Bear, they took up Brotherhood Week as one of their main causes in the 40s and 50s. The message was basically, it's un-American to discriminate. One thing, though, Brotherhood Week was created to promote tolerance and harmony among Catholics, Jews, and Protestants. It didn't include other faiths, not at first. And it didn't talk about race for a long time. So why did National Brotherhood Week die out? Well, some say it lost its relevance during the Civil Rights era. It was increasingly ridiculed as something that ignored the realities of life in America. Still, the movement and the way people grabbed onto it says something about the way Americans want to see themselves, even if it's not true yet. For The World, I'm Jennifer Gorin.
Coming up next on the show, we meet the American coach of Afghanistan's national women's soccer team and why she's actually never been there. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It is a familiar sports story.
Growing up in America, the bad news bears, like, we are pulling it together, we're finding a way, we're building a professional system, and I think everyone recognizes we're at the starting point.
If you've ever coached a sports team, you know how hard it can be to get the players motivated, especially younger ones, and keep them that way over many games. Then complicate that by coaching a team, a soccer team, that's far from the world's best.
There is no comparison to the U.S. women's national team. We can be in the top 60 to 80 in the world.
Then add a layer of insecurity.
We begin with that breaking news from Afghanistan, a devastating terror attack in the capital, an ambulance made to help.
A moment ago, you heard the voice of Kelly Lindsay, the American coach of the Afghanistan women's national soccer team. She's played soccer since she was a kid, and in many ways, her life so far has been in preparation for her current job. So you're a former college player at Notre Dame, also played here in the U.S. and made four appearances for the U.S. women's national team. But coaching the Afghan women's national team, that's a completely different sort of challenge. You've been doing it now for what, 2 years?
3 years.
How's it going?
It's been a life-changing, wonderful experience. I'm a major competitor. I will beat my nieces and nephews at anything. But I also recognize the power of sport to be a beautiful vehicle to empower lives and really help people be their best. And this is – couldn't ask for a better group of girls to help empower lives with.
So kind of a dream position, but had you thought, like, when you were younger, maybe one day I'll coach the women's team of a beleaguered, a war-torn country?
Never dreamed of it. My friends will joke because in college I would often say, peace in the Middle East, that's where we need it the most. And ironically enough, now I'm sitting in the Middle East working with a team from Central Asia trying to bring peace in that idea. So
you said you're in the Middle East, but Afghanistan isn't in the Middle East. So is that where you practice?
We look for a lot of help across Asia. Southeast Asia, Central Asia, the Middle East, we've been able to reach out to a number of countries asking for help and support to host our camps.
Right. And how much time do you spend in Afghanistan as a team and as a coach?
I have never been to Afghanistan. As a team, we don't go because there's many of our girls that probably don't want to or can't go back to the country as refugees and immigrants. Our goal is to find safe places outside of Afghanistan so everyone who comes to camp can feel safe and can train and feel good about the environment.
So the team itself, do they hail from Afghanistan or are they kind of in the Afghan diaspora?
We are from all over the world. We are immigrants and refugees, and we pull straight out of Kabul as well.
So why are the players on the team in it? What do they tell you?
To bring hope and opportunities for young girls in the country.
And I mean, a lot of teams are about winning. Is it also about winning, or would you say first comes a more intangible goal?
Underlying it all, we want to be in the World Cup. So being in the World Cup means we have to win. Everyone recognizes where we're starting from, maybe 30, 40 years behind the rest of the world as far as development goes. When we'll get to that tangible goal of winning, who knows? But in the meantime, there's a much more intangible goal that we all fight for daily, which is to empower women around the world.
What about the funding challenge? I mean, like, who pays your salary? Who pays the players? And you guys have a really big travel budget, too, I imagine.
We have a huge travel budget. Our entire staff is volunteer. The Federation does what they can, but it's a huge budget to have to travel to every trip. We're talking $60,000 to $80,000 every time we go somewhere. The federations have stepped up from across Asia, which we can only be grateful and appreciative for. And we fundraise for everything else. We beg all of our friends and family, and we go try to find sponsors and people who appreciate this journey. And it would not happen without an entire village of people globally who have stepped in and given us some funds.
Can you just tell me about one player that you've seen really change, just evolve, thanks to this team?
Yeah, I'm going to keep her name under wraps. She is from Kabul. And the very first training camp she came to, you could tell right away she was a great player. But one of the hardest things about building this team is a very simple word, trust. Growing up in a war-torn country, it's got to be really hard to know who to trust. And some of the stories I've heard from the girls of their past and their growing up was they were never allowed to leave the house because of Taliban rule, but also because nobody knew whose side the neighbor was on. So this young woman who showed up in India with us for SAF, she had a lot of football talent, but man, she just struggled to trust us. She actually spoke back to me. She tried to run away. You could feel this anger for the world, for everything. When she came back to camp in Jordan, she was 100% changed, 180 degrees.
What happened?
I think the realization of what a great opportunity it was. The realization that, wow, these coaches have stuck with us for 3 years. I don't think they're doing this for themselves. And I think that's a big thing for these women in Afghanistan. They've had people from the outside come in and give them a camp or give them a clinic or give them money. And then these people leave and they go make a movie or they go write a book. And they feel very taken about it. Mm-hmm. Like, you came and you told us we should trust you. And you went off and you made a movie or you made a book and you never gave back to us again. And I think the fact that we are all volunteers and they know it, we love them more than they will ever know as human beings first and treat them as human beings first. Every action, every word, every thought, we got to think about building trust amongst each other and teach each other how to build trust.
How has this experience with the Afghan national women's team changed the way you see soccer?
You know, as an American who grew up with parents who supported it and brothers who supported it and club system and coaches all around, I honestly didn't truly think about women's empowerment and rights for a long time. I recognize how I took that for granted because I'd never had to fight for the right to play football because I was a girl. Maybe I had to fight to get to that next team, that regional team or the national team, like that sort of fight, but never the fight of like with your neighbors, with your community to say that you are not a woman. You are disgraceful for playing sports. The names that these girls get called. And I realized very quickly how women across the world are seen as second and third class citizens. And it changed my whole mindset. And it made me want to fight harder for this team.
What can you tell us from your experience working with Afghan women? Not in Afghanistan, understood. But what are we not getting, the United States, what are we not getting right about Afghanistan? What don't we understand that you think you've seen some kind of glimmer of a solution or some glimmer of a reality?
It's actually a really beautiful place with really beautiful people. And I thought about this a lot because my first team meeting with the team, I thought, here I am, an American, walking into a room of women that come from a very different background than me. Like, how are we going to do this? And my first question to them was, why are you here? They had two answers. One was, when the word Afghanistan is said, the first thing people respond with is terrorism, hatred, Taliban, anger, war. They want to change that word. And the second thing they said was, you know, creating this hope for a better future in women. And the war is above my pay grade, but the people are amazing. And I know what they want for their country. And if we can help in any way, any little tidbit of opportunity, I think that we're giving back.
Kelly Lindsay is the coach of Afghanistan's women's national soccer team. Great to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Marco. Appreciate it.
I'm Marco Werman. The girl in the photo, Kim Phuc, burning and naked after a napalm attack. It became an iconic image of the Vietnam War.
And I just have so much questions at that time. Why me? Why I still alive? What the purpose for my life?
Now she dedicates her life to helping others. Her story still ahead on the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Kim Phuc was born almost exactly 2 years after me, which means that when I saw that famous photo of her, I was 11, and she would have been 9. Beyond that, the circumstances couldn't have been more different. You will likely know that photo of Kim Phuc from 1972, taken by Vietnamese AP photographer Nick Ut. In it, Kim was naked on a street, in pain and in tears, her skin on fire after being hit by a South Vietnamese napalm attack.
I remember my thought, oh my goodness, I got burned and I am not normal anymore. So people will see me different way.
For the next 15 minutes or so, you're going to hear my conversation with Kim Phuc. She's lived with that event and the scars for over 45 years. As you can imagine, it has been a defining moment in her life.
I remember on June 8, 1972, as a child, we just allowed to play in the inside of the temple nearby the bomb shelter. And I remember after lunch, we heard the noise, some burning outside, but then suddenly the soldiers asked the children to run out of the temple. And I was among of them, like my brothers and my cousins. Then I remember I just ran and I saw the airplane very fast, very loud. And as a child, I didn't know anything. And I turned my head. I saw 4 bombs landing down. So I heard the noise, boop, 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 boop. Then suddenly the fire was everywhere around me. I didn't see anybody else. And then the fire just burned off my clothes. And I saw the fire on my left arm. Then I used my right hand to wrap it up. That's why my right hand got burned as well.
You just put the fire out with your hand.
Yes. That moment I was terrified, you know. Then I ran out of that fire. And then I saw my brothers and my cousin and some soldiers with us. It probably is South Vietnamese soldiers who protect us in the temple. Then we kept running and running and running until I was so tired to run anymore. And I saw the a lot of people, they stood on the street. And I cried out, "Too hot, too hot." And I remember one of the soldiers, he gave me some water to drink. Because I cried out, "Too hot, too hot," he tried to help me. He poured the water over my skin. At that moment, I passed out. I didn't remember anything. I lost consciousness.
Wow.
That's that day.
And the famous photograph was taken at some point while you were running down that road. How much of your body was burned? Do you still have the scars?
Yes, I got burned from my neck down to my bum and all my left arm, my right hands, all the part of in my back.
After you lost consciousness, do you remember the following week?
Oh, for a long time, I have no idea when my memory come back. But after I got burned, I had a dream. I really wanted to become a doctor. Then I got into medicine school. But then at that moment, the Vietnamese government, rediscover me. I was that little girl in the famous picture, right?
Yeah.
So many foreign journalists came to Vietnam and they wanted to interview me. So because of that reason, I was put out of my school.
What, to basically do publicity?
Yes. And I eventually, I couldn't continue to go to school anymore. And that is a really low point in my life. I didn't have any freedom to do whatever I wanted as a student.
Yeah.
Until 1986, the Vietnamese government sent me to Cuba to study for 6 years. Then I married with a Vietnamese student who I met in my university. Then after that, we had permission to go to Moscow for our honeymoon.
How's Moscow for a honeymoon site?
We had no choice.
We'll like it whether we like it or not.
That's right. Oh, anyhow, on the way back to Cuba, our airplane had the schedule to stop in Gander, Newfoundland, Canada for refueling. So for 1 hour in that occasion, I took my chance and we stayed in Canada, my husband and I.
Yeah, so you defected.
Yeah, we defected in Canada. Then our life set up in Toronto. We have freedom in Canada. Sorry.
We got to wait for the dog to go.
Okay. Because of the caregiver come to my house, take care of my mom. Can you just hang on?
Yeah, we'll wait.
Sorry, just
okay.
Hang on there.
What kind of dog do you have?
Oh, Cockapoo.
Oh.
Yeah,
Aussie
he's cat. So good. He's awesome.
So it sounds like the chapter with your time in Cuba was somewhat bumpy, but let me go back to the mental scars, not just the physical scars from Vietnam, but the mental scars of you running down a road in Vietnam. Are you still haunted by that moment, and how have you kind of battled the psychological pain?
Honestly, that took me a while. I was endured so much. emotional pain. I went through so much nightmare. I was so scared. And I thought, honestly, with the scar on my body, when I growing up, I never have a boyfriend. I never thought nobody married me, even though I can have a normal life like everyone else. That is in my thought all day and night. And it's not easy. Yeah. In the beginning, I was so disabled. My neck, my arm, my hands, it was so ugly. I was not a child anymore. It's not like 9 years old, but I'm 19 years old. And I just have so much questions at that time. Why me? Why I still alive? What the purpose for my life? And my life is so darkness, no hope, no joy, no future. And I didn't know who I can talk to. And that's why I just asked God, where are you? I just seeking the answer.
At some point, though, that changed, right? What you went through, it did end up by informing a lot of your life and your work. For example, you work these days to help other child victims of war. So,
right. I really wanted to tell all the children who suffer like me, please have a dream. Keep your dream alive. It's just like that little girl I did.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Kim Phuc. She was the girl in the iconic napalm photo from the Vietnam War.
I share with my friends. They say, okay, if you want to continue to help people, you can do another way. So they helped me to establish the Kim Foundation International. Through that foundation, I want to help children who are victims of war, who are underprivileged, and I just dedicated my life to help others. I want to give back. Mm. Like now, any kind of tragedy come to their life, I has been there.
Right. And what goes through your own mind, Kim, when you hear those other stories? Does it help you in your own recovery, or does it re-traumatize you?
Both. Mm. You know, I went to Uganda, and it's a big challenge for me to get back to the burned unit. It's all the bad memory come back to me.
Yeah.
And I hesitated to get into the burned unit. But I say to me, I say, Kim, that's why you are here. You need to reach out to help people. And then finally, I get in, and I remember I met a child, 3 years old. His mother just stayed nearby his bed, and I talked with her, and I just really love that little boy. Mm. And then another lady, I went to visit her. She's just no hope. She really wanted to die. She didn't want to eat. But then I have opportunity to give her my picture.
That famous photograph of you running down a road in Vietnam and after a napalm attack?
Yes. And I say to her, I got burned so badly like you. And I was just 9 years old. And she just listened. I share with her about my pain, my thought that I wanted to die. I didn't want to leave anymore, but now I'm here and you have to accept it. And I'm here. Can I pray for you? And she didn't change anything. But when I left the burned unit, the nurse told me, wow, Kim, it's a big impact in her life. After you left, she stood up. She kept smiling, walking on the hallway, and she went to eat. She went to leave. And I think, wow, the moment I can help one life, give her hope, thinking your life would not end there.
Well, it sounds like that visit really affected you.
Yes, me, yes. I found that it's so meaningful for me, and I just so thankful. That's why I'm alive.
You have this such an optimistic view of how things can proceed in life, Kim, after you went through so much. Are you ever angry?
No.
Why not?
Right now, no. But before, yes. Because of my life, I learned a lot. Before, I hold the hatred for a while. Yes, I do. Oh, I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned to forgive. I learned to love my enemies. That is from learning. I'm not born with that. I was raised in a different religion. I was raised in the Cao Dai religion in Vietnam. But I was missing something. And I just wonder, where are you, God? But then finally, I went to the library and I had read so many religious books. And among that, I read the Bible. Then I changed my attitude, changed my behavior. I love my scars. And because of that picture, I got the best treatment later on. And I went through 16 operations, but unfortunately, I still have a lot of pain. So recently, around 2.5 years ago, I went through 10 laser treatments in order to help to ease my pain.
Kim, I know you've got kids and grandkids. Have they ever seen the famous photo that was taken of you after that napalm fire? Do they see your scars and want to know why? And what do you tell them to keep them positive about humanity?
I always teach them the truth. And they know my scars. They know my suffering. They know everything. I cannot hide anything from them. I continue to teach them why our mommy got that scar and pain and suffering. But then I tell them, because I still have a life and I still have you, but be thankful to be alive. And I never, never take it for granted in my life. I count what I have, but I'm not think about what I lost.
Final question. Are you still in touch with Nick Oot, the photographer?
Yeah, I call him Uncle Oot, and he called me all the time, all the time.
Kim Phuc, it's an absolute delight to speak with you, and I think it gives all of us great buoyancy to hear that after all this time, you sound so happy and optimistic.
Thank you so much.
To this day, that photo of Kim Phuc is imprinted in my mind. Yours too, right? I mean, who can forget that picture? Kim's agonized face, also the other traumatized children in the photo. What do you remember about the effect the picture had on you? Our Facebook page is open for your comments and thoughts. Just look for PRI's The World on Facebook. Remember the Costa Concordia? That's the Italian cruise ship that hit a rock and capsized off the coast of Tuscany after its captain changed course to show off for observers on shore. Hard to believe, but it's been 6 years since that tragedy. 32 people were killed, and after a lot of legal wrangling, the captain is now serving a 16-year prison sentence. One of the survivors of the ordeal is Antimo Magnotta. He was one of the pianists entertaining guests on board the ship.
I mean, that day, that night, is still haunting my sleep and never deserted me, actually. I lost my sleep. I lost my peace of mind, and I was on the edge of a nervous breakdown, because right after that shipwrecking, I was just running on adrenaline. It was running through my veins, and I couldn't sleep. I couldn't play with my daughter. Of course, I was totally broken.
Magnotta told the BBC he was so traumatized by the shipwreck that he actually gave up playing the piano for a while. He moved to London, where he took a job as a waiter at a cafe inside the Victoria and Albert Museum. It just so happened, though, that the cafe had a piano, and eventually Antimo worked his way back to the keys. Now, 6 years later, he's written a piano piece to remember the people who perished on the Costa Concordia.
This piece is called 32, and is a tribute to the memory of these 32 people who were just on the very same journey as I was. The main melody played by the right hand is formed of 32 notes, and every single note is a tribute to every single victim of this tragedy.
A small sample of Antimo Magnotta's 32, a composition he wrote to honor those people who died when the Costa Concordia capsized off the coast of Tuscany 6 years ago. Finally, we have an A-side B-side for you. The world's future folk producer, Brandy Fullwood, often listens to music that serves as a link to the cultures of previous generations. Today, since our eyes are already trained on the Olympics in South Korea, Brandy's finding out what connects K-pop to traditional Korean music.
I've been reading a lot about K-pop, and article after article mentions how Western it is with a Korean twist. With contemporary K-pop, I can pick out clear R&B, Europop, and trap influences. But there are also clear socio-political influences, and those even go back further in traditional Korean music, which is how I'll connect the A-side to the B-side. In the Smithsonian Folkways archives, songs like Tarachi Taryung, performed by Kim Uk-sim, are part of a history. In 1122 BC, Chitsu, a Chinese overlord, brought music and instruments into northern Korea, which explains why traditional Korean music is based on the pentatonic scale. There are these small notes that our ears can pick out of broad ideas that expose clear influences. And this is what happens with K-pop as well.
K-pop itself is a very genre-fluid thing. It's not like K-pop's not a genre. It's just, you know, popular music, right?
That's Cedar Boseji. She teaches Korean studies at the University of British Columbia. We move away from traditional music to talk about trot. Seiji calls trot the grandparent to today's K-pop. And no surprise, it's also politically influenced. Korean trot music resembles enka, a Japanese genre that's closely tied to traditional music of Japan. Trot music emerged from the Japanese occupation of Korea from 1910 to 1945. It has notes of polka and the foxtrot.
Trot has this very, very strong beat, and it tends to be like this 2-4 meter. People call it bong jak because that's what the beat sounds like. Bong jak, bong jak.
After the occupation, trot music changed again.
The Korean government started to censor music, and one of the reasons was if it was too foreign, particularly too Japanese. So if the trot sounded too Japanese or appeared to be too Japanese, then those songs would actually be banned.
Seiji says the government was insistent on reestablishing a Korean national identity, even through music.
Trot tried to really rebrand itself as being Korean. A lot of that rebranding that was happening at that time was removing elements that seemed to be distinctly Japanese, like using the Japanese scale.
Trot musicians use more Western sounds and instruments to create this difference and distance from any Japanese culture. But visually, they brought out more Korean cultural artifacts.
This is like the elemental heartbeat music of Korea. This is what people think of when they think of nostalgia and hometown and, you know, true Korean values.
All right, the B-side. Connecting K-pop with earlier music like trot or even traditional music is not really about sound. Admittedly, K-pop doesn't sound like traditional Korean music, and it doesn't even always sound like trot. Give or take a few songs from artists like Psy. Today's K-pop, much like its earlier iterations, is also politically shaped. K-pop performers, in addition to being great dancers and singers, are attractive and excessively talented. They're trained to be perfect. It's like the standard of Motown with 10 times the pressure. Their image, because of political censorship, is strict. Stars are expected to follow traditional gender roles and subject matters, but performers playfully subvert those rules. I learned from Seiji that when K-pop was still trot, traditional Korean values helped to distinguish popular culture from Japanese influence. Now it's less about that particular comparison and more about enhancing a distinct Korean wave of culture. From live performances to music videos, K-pop certainly does this. It resembles a lot of things, but it's also come into its own sound profile. Even with the influences in mind, it can be extremely polished, vibrant, well-rounded, and distinct. For the world, I'm Brandy Fuller.
That's Heart Attack by Luna. A side B-side is part of the world's collaboration with Smithsonian Folkways. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.